Hello and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Andy Rao. Well, you've probably guessed that something is a little different about this episode because Chris usually does this little introduction. Chris is out. He's doing fine. I understand he's playing a lot of Baldur's Gate 3. And in the meantime, I am joined by a friend of the podcast and a GM of the podcast and someone who has been on the show once or twice, although it's been a while, Matt Wilson. So Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andy. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt is a GM that Chris and I both really admire. Partly, Matt, because you're really good at what you do, but you've also run a number of games that are on me and Chris's white whale list. So the last game of yours I played in was Deathmatch Island, I think.
Does that sound right? Yes, I think so.
Before we jump into our topic proper, have you been reading or watching anything that's been getting your GM brain spinning?
You know, I started watching this really interesting short animated series that my wife got into a little bit ago called Over the Garden Wall. Oh. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, Andy, but
I don't think I have.
In like 2014, and the episodes are only 11 minutes long, and it's sort of animated in this like very old-fashioned 40s-ish style. But it starts you right in with these two brothers who are wandering in the woods, kind of lost. And it's kind of a good spooky season thing. There's they encounter a scary woodsman, and then there's some kind of beast. And, you know, I won't spoil too much about all of the different adventures that they have, but it's incredible to me how much adventure and pathos and reference they're able to put into these short little 10-minute clips. And because each week kind of like just starts in, like, they don't dwell a lot on how they got from the end of the last episode to where the new episode begins, which kind of reminded me a lot of some tabletop gaming adventures. Yeah. Like, let's, you know, this week we're doing this. Now it's sometime later in the forest and we're encountering this. So
that makes me think of, you know, the difference between, you know, Tolkien, where it's one big plotted story or versus like Robert Howard, where like in this story, Conan is a king for some reason, even though when we last left him, he was on the other side of the world. It's two very different ways to tell a story about heroes.
Right. And there's definitely an ongoing narrative in this, but they just don't, you know, they're not doing the 24 thing where they're clocking every minute or whatever.
I guess I should mention something I've been listening to, and I know you've been listening to it too, because I've infected a few of you of others with it. I re-listened to the BBC podcast, the Lovecraft Investigations. And these are, if you haven't listened to this, listeners, go out and check it out. I give it a strong recommendation. These are basically H.P. Lovecraft short stories retold as sort of like in the style of a true crime, or not an investigation or crime podcast.
Yeah, the podcast conceit is that it starts out like they're doing a season of Serial or something like that on a Lovecraftian, what turns into a Lovecraftian story. Yeah.
The second time around, I've been listening to it a little bit more specifically with kind of running Call of Cthulhu games in mind. And I don't know what you think of this. When I listen to it, I can almost hear the GM as the podcast goes on. I can almost hear the GM throwing out a large number of clues or leads and seeing which ones the players to grab onto and decide to pursue. And then they go down that trail for a little while. And as they go down that trail, the GM throws out a few other leads or ideas. And then some of those, the characters grab onto, and others of them kind of, other of them don't land. So they get set to the side. After doing that for a couple of episodes, the players have almost by themselves created connections between all of these different things. Like, even if the GM did not have a real specific route planned out, the players have have signaled what they think is important, and they've made their own connections between those things. And suddenly, to me, that seems very, the GM is very empowered at that point to throw in twists, or, you know, which happens in the podcast, usually in the form of, you know, somebody they're interacting with is not actually who they think it is, or, you know, something like that. And I don't know, what do you think about that? Is that how you run a, you know, a Call of Cthulhu style game?
That's a really interesting idea. There are a number of podcasts that, you know, both you and I like that kind of do something similar. And I do hear it more with the Lovecraft investigations than I do with, say, something more like Tanis, which has a similar concept of being a true crime podcast about ultimately cosmic horror sort of things. But yeah, there is something of the structure that like a gumshoe game like Trail of Cthulhu gets to with the Lovecraft investigations. But what you're kind of hinting at almost is more of like a gauntlet carved from Brindlewood sort of approach, where there are clues going on, and as our podcast hosts slash players are putting them together, they're in many ways kind of driving the story around. I think there's a couple of ways that you can get there, but that is very similar to the structure, I think, of a well-run mythos investigation game, for sure.
Yeah, and obviously it's tightly scripted, so this is not an improv, you know, show. But it, you know, it, you mentioned gumshoe, and it calls to mind the Dracula dossier campaign, where it's really just a big cloud of stuff.
Constellation of interesting things.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And the players jump in at the point that interests them. And by the time they've been doing that for a while, they will have bumped into all the important stuff, or the GM will have brought the important stuff into their vicinity, right?
Yeah. I don't run a ton of like open world, like hex crawly emergent narrative sort of games, but I did run 7th C sort of like that, where I had a bunch of different plot ideas, and I, like you described there, I just kind of kept laying clues to a bunch, you know, where they would be relevant to any, you know, a bunch of different directions that the players might go, and as they started to get interested in things, kind of de-emphasize the ones that were not interesting to them, and followed where the players' noses were leading them a little bit.
That's as good an intro as any to our main topic. And the topic we'll be discussing today is, how do you, the GM, prepare for a long or complicated campaign? This is a topic that is very relevant, I feel, to me, and I know to you. So when I saw this question, my mind, you know, went immediately to the epic kind of published campaigns, like the ones that top, you know, get the, what are the greatest, you know, published campaigns in RPGs. So you get things like Masks of Nyarlathotep, you get the Great Pendragon campaign, you get Traveler's Guide, Pirates of Drinax.
The Enemy Within.
The Enemy Within for Warhammer. Yeah, there's probably some others that I'm blanking on, but so my mind with this question, when I think big, long, complicated campaign, I think published campaign that I'm trying to run. Yeah. But one of the first questions I want to ask you, Matt, and this is a topic where you have, I have little experience with this, and you have a lot more, so I'm hoping to learn here.
I'll do my best.
You have run a couple of these big, complicated campaigns, right?
Yeah.
So tell us some of the stuff you've run.
In terms of versions of published campaigns, I've run Masks of Nyarlathotep. I've run Eternal Lies. I am currently running The Enemy Within. I have run a version of Curse of Strahd. I think those are the big published ones.
Really, yep. Just those four epic campaigns.
Right? Yep.
That's fantastic. So tell us about the last time. You were currently running Enemy Within, right?
I am, yep.
So how did you decide that you wanted to run that? And why did you decide to run that campaign instead of, like, say, a campaign of your own devising?
I guess I should preface that by saying that whenever I run a published campaign, I like to use it more as inspiration than running it as written. And I think that's something that a published campaign can give you, those sort of story hooks, those sort of epic scenes that you get in your mind that you then want to use in other places. So in terms of choosing one of those, I like to find something that is either trying something in a campaign structure that I haven't seen before. For instance, in The Enemy Within, the third section of that campaign is to me the most bonkers proposition ever put to a GM, just in terms of what goes on and what they're expecting you to do in part three of that campaign.
Is there a way you can, in a non-spoilery way, tell us what that is?
Yeah, so Warhammer has this like through line in many of its published scenarios of like this master clock of events that are going on with all these different intersecting plot lines, and the players are sort of getting in there in the gears and detangling all these things. The third section of The Enemy Within is like that taken to the nth degree. It takes place over a midwinter festival. The players have 7 days, and there's this massive city with all this stuff happening in it, and they have to figure out what the meta plot is that connects all these danger, all of these like when they go into it, they aren't even necessarily aware what the problem is, but they know that because they're playing in a role-playing game, there must be something going on here. And by the
and
end
they're
of
playing
it,
Warhammer, so it's real bad. So.
Right, exactly. It's super bad. But they're like, you know, there's like 30 NPCs, and every day's got a clock and a calendar of events. Oof. And they've got to figure out what's going on, who's behind it, and how to stop it on a tight timer.
Let's put a pin on that because I want to maybe, because talking about managing those timers and calendars, I think is something we should talk about when we talk about running big campaigns. Yeah. But yeah, so, but you were talking about why you chose it, and you were saying that you look for campaigns that basically are doing something you haven't done or that's interesting.
Something interesting, something I haven't done, some hook that I think is interesting. And then I usually like to try and mutate it, change it, make it my own in some way.
Can I ask, what are some of those hooks that got you interested in Curse of Strahd and Eternal Lies?
Yeah,
and Masks?
Sure, briefly. Curse of Strahd is like probably the first published adventure module that makes the villain somebody who is not just evil for their own sake, but relatable in some way.
Yeah.
Because it's a retelling of the Dracula story.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, it adds this element where every time the players enter the scenario, there's a tarot reading, effectively, that randomizes the distribution of things in that setting.
Can I ask, did you run that as a random thing? Because
I did.
Looking up Curse of Strahd advice, you see a lot of people on Reddit saying stack the tarot deck.
You do. I was doing something else with it, with the campaign. I ran it actually using the Blades in the Dark rules. So there were other things going on there, but what really got me interested in it was the ability to retell the Dracula story and subvert some of the more tropey details of that.
Yeah.
And also do this kind of randomization thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm not going to just grill you on this, I promise. Sure, but the campaign you mentioned that I'm least familiar with is Eternal Lies. What's the hook that you got on that one?
So Eternal Lies takes place roughly 10 years after Mass of Nyarlathotep. And the premise of Eternal Lies is that 10 years ago, a party of investigators suffered a total party kill while attempting to avert a Lovecraftian occult ritual during an eclipse. And I thought, interesting, because Mass of Nyarlathotep ends trying to subvert a Lovecraftian, with the party trying to subvert a Lovecraftian ritual during an eclipse. Right? So these two are kind of, I wanted to give my players the idea with Eternal Lies that maybe they had failed actually at the end of Mass of Nyarlathotep.
Oh, yeah.
with that setup.
That is devious.
And they were playing characters that knew the surviving party members from the mass campaign. So it was set in a continuous universe, if you will, based on how our version of mass had ended. There were some things that were different in the world, but
yeah,
still recognizable. So I told it as a film noir continuation, I guess, of the mass storyline, sort of to connect it back to our podcast talk from earlier. It was like the Lovecraft investigations, where the stories kind of tie together in some way.
When you had the idea to run something like this, I'm thinking about how you pitch something like this to your players.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's kind of interesting to me is the different experience you get when you say, we are going to run campaign X. It will take approximately this amount of real life time.
Uh-huh.
You know, who here, and here's the schedule and pace we want to do. Who's in versus, uh-huh, hey guys, let's meet up and just start playing Call of Cthulhu or whatever. Right. And why go for like a kind of a campaign that has a structure and boundaries around it versus like just running basically the same story, but presenting it to your players as kind of an ongoing thing. Is there a difference between those experiences?
That's a great question. I think there is slightly, and it comes down to player expectations. Part of my pitch documents, or my pitch to my players, documents makes it sound so formal. I do provide people with a one-page pitch for the adventure. But I think that by selling it as a contained, you know, like overarching story, a big connected storyline with the following themes and points of reference, you can get player buy-in to A, pursuing that theme and that storyline, because oftentimes in role-playing games, especially when you're asking players to put their characters' lives at risk against the mythos, there's some element of buy-in that has to happen there. But also knowing that you're going into a long story arc that will hopefully resolve in a satisfying epic way, I think does help with player buy-in to other things that might go on during the campaign.
If you're running a campaign for a year, it's maybe hard to talk about the pacing of that campaign, because we're talking about dozens or hundreds of hours of play. But I think everyone consciously or unconsciously is going to bring in that ideas we have about how stories are shaped, and maybe be able to lean into those with more confidence than if it was just weekly D&D night and until the end of time. Right. So you just mentioned that before your campaigns, you give your players a sheet of info. What do you put on that sheet, and why do you write that?
Yeah, I write that in part for myself, because I usually include in that some media references, like, if you're going to play Blades in the Dark, the Blades in the Dark rulebook includes this sort of information. Like, think about Peaky Blinders and, this and that. And, so I include some of that information as well, and set the general, theme and tone for the campaign as a whole. That's valuable for me as the GM, because it sort of focuses my ideas for the campaign. And is something that I can come back to and say, what am I trying to do with this story? Like, oh, right, I'm trying to tell a story that lives up to this pitch document here. Right. And then for the players, they can look at that and say, this sounds really exciting. Like, internalize, I'm excited to see how the world has changed in, 10 years on from this film noir thing. We're going to start in Hollywood. And I talked about it's going to be lies and truth. What do you love? What is love? What are you willing to sacrifice to save the world? Like, those are the questions I'm going to be asking your characters. Like, are you interested in trying to answer those at the table?
Can I ask a question to which I'm looking for a very literal answer here?
Sure.
Like, how you've just decided you're going to run Curse of Strahd. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Like, what literally do you do to like to get ready for that?
Right.
Like, can you talk? I have some thoughts about this too. But can you talk a little bit about what your like actual, what is Matt physically doing to prepare for this? What does that look like for you? And how much time do you spend on that?
Yeah, I have a couple of partially written blog posts I hope to publish someday on this subject.
Well, they're getting spoiled here, so.
That's okay. This may sound weird, but once I've picked the skeleton that I want to tell, the first thing I do physically is I put together a playlist of music.
Oh. This is not what I expected you to say.
No, but I think having a thematic playlist is super important.
Oh, wow.
Because that is then something that I put on while I'm working on everything else.
Okay.
And, you know, I might add stuff or take stuff away as I'm working on it, but having, like, I'm the sort of person that likes to work to a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always music going on and when I'm working at my day job, when I'm working on games. So having music that's putting me in the right frame of mind for what I'm trying to do is important. And then the next thing that I do from there is I start thinking about the campaign's villains. Those are so important, I think, to the success of these long-running games.
Yeah.
Like, you have to, as the GM, understand what the villains are trying to accomplish and give them realistic, you know, believable, coherent motivations and activities that they can be pursuing while the players are getting involved in the story. Picking out a published campaign like Mass and Arlathotep gives you all of these scenes and this structure that you could start filling your own ideas into. And for me, the first and most important idea are the villains, because it's all going to come down to you want your players to love to hate those guys. Them being able to predict the villains' movements, you know, once they've gotten to know them and predict their weak spots or understand what they're trying to do, really elevates that. So for something like Mass of Nyarlathotep or Eternal Lies, those were the biggest changes I made. The changes were to the villains themselves.
A common piece of advice you will get about running Curse of Strahd, but also different like of the Paizo Pathfinder adventure paths, you will commonly hear people saying, be sure to like bring the villain in at a regular pace and establish some kind of a relationship, even if it's a purely antagonistic one, with the players. You know, especially with your more D&D type campaigns, it's kind of hard in that, like, especially that kind of dungeon fantasy thing. This idea of like you go through the dungeon, you go through the dungeon or the adventure, and you get to the bad guy that's waiting for you at the end. Presumably that bad guy is really bad and deserves what's coming to him. So you can rely on players bringing some of their own kind of emotion to the story. But I think one of the reasons Curse of Strahd works is that Strahd has like really clear reasons to engage with the players long before they like bust down the castle door to take him out. Right.
Right.
So
absolutely. And even once they're in there with Strahd, they can be finding things out about Strahd.
Yeah.
That humanize him to a certain extent, him or her, depending on how you've done that. But I think getting your players to meet the villains early, and ideally in a way like before they know that they're antagonists. And there's always the old like plant a spy amongst their midst trope that you can get away with a couple of times. Like,
yeah,
my Mass of Nyarlathotep campaign, my playgroup picked up the services of a graduate student, a young African-American woman who was struggling to get her point across to the police in New York. She knew about, you know, the Silas Nkwame, the Cult of the Bloody Tongue stuff there. And you know, was interested in the player, you know, trying to avert that superficially. And the players picked her up and they felt sympathetic towards her. And she had this very strong anti-colonialist bent. That's how I introduced them to Maweru, who was one of the big tentpole villains of that whole arc.
That is clever, yeah.
spent the entire campaign confiding in her and helping her. And from her perspective, she was using them to eliminate the other white men who were rivals in this in this cult.
That's fascinating. So I ran the first chunk of Masks of Nyarlathotep across over the course of maybe 9 months or a year, and I wish I had planted that seed. But yeah, okay, that's really good.
Yeah, little things like that. Yeah.
I want to ask you how much you look to other people online, to other people's experience running something when you start to run something. And I have a little anecdote I will share from preparing to run Curse of Strahd. And spoiler, I canned Curse of Strahd and moved to a Pathfinder adventure path because of this problem I'm about to describe.
Okay.
So when I decided to run Curse of Strahd, I spent lot of time reading every account on Reddit and all the forums and everything of people who had run it. And there is no shortage of, like, here's some tips for running Curse of Strahd. I picked up, if you go to drive-through, I think this is a wonderful thing. And I wish Wizards of the Coast and other game publishers would really call this stuff out more, but there's like this cloud of publications on a place like DriveThruRPG that's like companion materials for helping you run, well, any published D&D campaign, but specifically Curse of Strahd. There's a ton of Strahd stuff. So I ordered
She Is the Ancient is tremendous.
So I ordered two of these books. She Is the Ancient was one of them. It's a way to sort of play around with like the gender tropes of Curse of Strahd, and I ordered this absolutely monstrous Curse of Strahd companion, which is, you know, like, it's longer than, significantly longer than the and so I'm reading all this, and at a certain point it just was too much. It's too much, and I had taken so many notes about all the stuff I needed to be sure to do in Curse of Strahd. Don't forget to do this. Make sure when the PCs get here that this happens. Otherwise, this other thing will be totally ruined. So I had all this advice, and it was stressing me out. So I stopped. I mean, I'm not saying I'll never run Curse of Strahd, but I moved over to a Pathfinder adventure path, which they all are also long, complicated things, but they are much easier to just start running without having to think about all this stuff. So how do you have that problem? Are you smarter than me and you don't do any research? And if you do shop around to see what other people's experiences have been, what do you do with that? And how do you keep that from just like overloading your own, what interests you about the campaign?
Yeah, it's a great idea. Part of how I pick out the campaign in the first place, you know, like how does a campaign become well enough known that, you know, it's going to come to your attention, right? It's because people have written about it, right? So there is something of attention there for sure. But yeah, I definitely look for some examples of how people have taken that campaign and run it. And I'm definitely not perfect at this, but there's an art to finding a couple of inspirations and then being like, that's enough. versus trying to read everything on the internet. If I've picked a thing out, and let's just say that for Masks and Eternal Lies, a huge inspiration, I drew inspiration from three sources for those campaigns. And three is a decent number because that gets you some ideas, but not too many ideas. And your idea can be like one of four then, right?
Yep.
So it's there's still something that you're adding.
Is one of the sources you've drawn on like an actual play of a campaign?
They're usually actual plays. I do like seeing the thing that I get from actual plays that I find most valuable is if there's a particularly tricky spot in a campaign, or if an actual play and I have similar thematic ideas and I want to see how that played out. Like I knew going into Mass of Nyarlathotep and Eternalized that I wanted to do it in a film noir style. And I happened to find over, I'm spacing on the name of the forum, but one of those old forums, is a poster named Aviatrix, who I've mentioned before.
Oh, yes. I remember you mentioning
her. She writes up in these incredible actual plays for her stuff on storygames.com. And she also approached Mass and Eternalize from a very film noir, Hollywoodland perspective. So I was quite interested in that, and she was gender bending some things that I wanted to do as well. So I wanted to see how that played out. Similarly, in the Call of Cthulhu space, there's the British group, Yog-Sothoth, the Innsmouth House players. They tend to run things like as written. So if you want to see like how these campaigns unfold with very, you know, experienced veteran GMs and players, like usually doing things as they're laid out in the book, you know, go check that out. They hit some problems in Eternalize that were really interesting to me to see, like, oh, okay, that's interesting that, you know, this can go this way here. And then, you know, you'll probably find other things. There's so much out there nowadays, but I tend to look for a couple of sources like that, something close to the same theme as myself, something close to as written.
Maybe you've done this, but if you were to write one of those, a blog post or a big forum entry where you were like, this is how Eternal Lies went, what is the kind of actual play report that you think is most useful for someone who's starting afresh? That's a pretty intense question to throw at you there, I guess. But what I'm kind of trying to ask is, you know, like, what is useful? Is it, here's three broad pointers to keep in mind, or here are 50 posts detailing, you know, each session's worth of play. What made the sources you picked, like, so helpful to you?
I think a common thread in the sources that I have gotten a lot of value out of is that they spend some time talking about the goals and the like, the mechanics that they chose to accomplish those goals that they had for the story and the campaign, and then they have engaging write-ups or podcast sessions with the actual play. I find I get more value out of it when there's some out of narrative talk about here's what I was hoping to accomplish here, here's why it did or didn't happen, or here's the unexpectedly cool thing that I learned during the play of this chapter, or something like that. And then you can actually see how that played out. Yeah. I think that's a pretty common thing. I'll send you the link to the Enemy Within actual play
I'll put it in the show notes if you do.
That I've liked as well. That GM did a similar thing. It was like, hey, I'm making all these changes to Warhammer Fantasy so that I can tell the Enemy Within story the way I want to tell it. I'm thinking of doing that too. Like, let's see how this worked out for you.
So we're coming up on time here, so I don't want to keep you here for too much longer, but I do have one or two other questions I want to get at. First, I want to rewind just a little bit and talk about this probably differs from person to person, but what is the, you know, physical literal tool or set of tools or set of practices you use to keep a big campaign straight in your head?
These days I have borrowed a structure from Jason Alexander over at the Alexandrian, where on my computer in the folder for the campaign, I have numbered folders in there for like 0.0 is the campaign rules, 1.0 is like Act 1, Chapter 1. I divide campaigns up into acts and chapters.
Okay,
like a play, if you will, and then I keep the material for that in that chapter, and I tend to work a little bit ahead, like with decreasing levels of detail the further out from where my players are. Because you got to be able to fill stuff in based on what's actually happened. But also, you know, in those skeleton documents, then you have stuff that you know you're going to do in Act 3.
Yeah.
You got those ideas where you could go find them.
I found when I was running Masks, I went all in on using Microsoft OneNote. And I'm not saying that that's a perfect tool for everyone, but I will say for me, it was a nice, middle ground between just a giant Word document with all my stuff in it and like a really challenging for me to figure out tool like Obsidian or some of these other tools. And with OneNote and I found that that worked pretty well, but it did ask of me more time on like in between session document maintenance, I guess, than I'm used to. Do you use those Google Docs or whatever like that at the game table itself? Do you have a laptop open usually?
I usually print them out. I don't have a laptop open, but part of the reason to break it down into acts and scenarios is so that I can print that, just that part out, and I don't have to be flipping through the book. And that document will have everything I need for that session and sessions around it. And these days, I've kind of taken another page out of the Gauntlet Publishing's book and tried to make sure those documents are like, I think Jason Cordova calls them toy boxes of like, they're like, here are the locations, here are the people, and things are not necessarily statted out at a high level of detail in that document, but it's got all the questions I want to ask, the things I want to turn back to the players, and lists of things. So I can look at it, and it's like a quick reference sheet, basically, for the chapter.
Yeah. All right, last question here. And then, of course, if there's anything we haven't touched on that you feel would be important to bring up, by all means, speak up. Between you and the players, how does campaign chronicling happen? And what does that look like for you? So you just finished a session. What happens?
That's an interesting question. Honestly, not much. I mostly run investigative games or games that have investigative components. So my players do take notes. And that's a good behavior that I try to encourage. I take some notes as well, depending on the game and game system, more. How the session has gone, sometimes those notes aren't super great.
Have you ever looked back at like session notes and it's a couple of like it's a random declining like list of hit points for something that's not even described,
or it's just like some cryptic phrase and you're like, why did I write this down? This is not helpful at all. Then the session has ended, and then when I'm prepping the next session, I'll look at those notes, whatever I have, and look, try and remember what we were doing, and lay some more track for whatever is coming next.
Running Masks, it was never really a problem, but it made me laugh sometimes. I was running for my family, and one of the players was my teenager, and they kept pretty extensive notes, but like it was not super infrequent. I was so familiar with the material. I read it. I was thinking about it all the time, and I had it so organized, like on my computer and in my head, that I sometimes found that the players, I would lob them a clue or a reference and it would not land. And I'd be like, does this remind you of a piece of information you learned four sessions ago? And I'd get blank looks. And then my teenager would flip through their notes a little bit and they happened not to have written that down. And then it worked out great, partly because they're my family and we are here to have fun with this, not to
yeah.
not to stress too much about that. But is that a problem you haven't run into much?
Oh no, I think everyone runs into that problem. Yeah. I do open every session with a "So what happened last time, folks? What do you remember from last session?" Which, and that's actually the way I phrase it. What do you remember from last session? Because that tells me what they found interesting in the last session, for one, and for two, it lets me fill in any gaps as they go around the table and do the 5-minute last time on summary. But also in any kind of huge globe-trotting campaign where it might be months in between, all right, it's Remy LaCroix or whatever, you know, like, and right. then like yeah. months later you bring back Remy and they're like, who the heck is this again? like then you do have to step out of the flow of things sometimes and be like, ah, it's this guy, you know, once upon a time you found a tattoo that looked like this.
Yeah.
And some flipping of notes. That happens because these aren't the actual lives of the players.
Yeah. Yeah.
Masks is also interesting because it's so, the calendar is very important for that campaign in a way that it isn't for most campaigns. So when I ran Mass, I had physical printouts of a calendar for the month that my players were in with things that I knew were going to happen already filled in on the calendar. And then I would fill in the calendar with what my players were up to and any plans they had put in motion. I could tell them, oh, you'll find out, you know, you can run the serial number on that gun and you'll find out in 2 days. And then on my calendar, I'd put, give them clue X on this day.
Yeah, this is a whole, I guess we haven't really gotten to the calendar and timing thing and we're out of time now, but
sure.
When I was running Masks, I also had a calendar and I didn't realize that the calendar would serve this purpose, but it ended up being my single best like way of recording what the players had done, because I would just jot down on my calendar, nice. Oh, they talked to the police inspector on this day. And over time you fill up your calendar with a pretty good log of like where the players are and what they were doing. And that was very helpful to me to be able to go back later. Like, well, when did they talk to Erica Carlisle? When was that? Like, you know, that sort of thing. So
nice. Yeah. Yeah. It provides you with that narrative momentum that you're looking for in a game like that.
Absolutely. Sure. Okay. Well, hey, there's more we could talk about, but we've been going for a bit now.
Sure.
And I, Matt, I'm really grateful to you for the, for coming on here and sharing some of your insight and experience with us. I have a closing question for you. So you are in the middle of running Enemy Within, and based on what I know of that campaign, you could be running that still in 5 years from now, but I'm wondering if you have spotted anything out there or you are already ruminating in the back of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us maybe one or two other campaigns that have caught your interest, or maybe you see the glimmer of that hook that you need?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I have a little bit of a backlog of things, but on that list for sure is a Planescape campaign.
Oh, beautiful.
Based on Dead Gods.
Oh, yeah.
By Monte Cook. Then the Great Modron March. Been thinking about that since college. I'll run it someday.
Yeah.
What's
the hook on that one?
The hook is starting the campaign with your players at some astronomically high level of power, standing physically in the ether on a dead god, having done something, right?
Yeah.
And then we find out how we get there. How did this god die? Who is this god? And are they going to go through with it?
Okay, that's a good hook.
And then we've talked about it a little bit. Well, you and I have talked about it a bunch offline, but online, the Delta Green campaign, Impossible Landscapes, really catches my interest quite a bit. It's definitely something that I want to tackle at some point. And, you know, then there's also like some kind of science fiction also since college, but Transhuman Space is a GURPS setting that
piqued my interest. I did not expect those words to come out of your mouth, by the way.
Yeah,
that's great.
Piqued some interest in like the Expanse style storytelling of encountering hard science fiction encounter with an alien protomolecule in some way.
Yeah.
Before the Expanse was a thing, or altered carbon. There's something there.
Yep. Okay. Well, hey, I think we need to wrap it up. So thank you. This has been Roll for Topic. We're part of the Roll for It Media Network. Our sister show, The Splatbook, hosted by John Corey and some other lovely co-hosts, has recently had some really good episodes. Matt, do I recall correctly that you recently were on The Splatbook and got a chance to interview some gaming luminaries that are relevant to the campaigns we've just been discussing?
I did indeed. I was fortunate enough that John let me on the podcast to talk to Ken Hyde and Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, two writers that I really admire, who've written a lot of stuff that I quite enjoy.
Yeah.
Trail of Cthulhu second edition is crowdfunding now, and they've made a bunch of changes that I think are really great.
I don't know if I could be in that interview without doing the Wayne's World, like, we're not worthy thing over and over again. But
there was some of that. We tried to keep it cool.
All right. Well, hey, thanks very much for joining us. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back next time with Chris. Will be back, assuming he's beaten Baldur's Gate 3 or whatever else he's up to by that time. And thank you for listening, and catch you next time.
Work on your villains.
Oh, hey, you know what? This is why I need Chris around here.
Yeah.
Remember, if your players are having fun, you're a great GM.